Thanatophobia, the fear of death and dying, is a universal human condition that informs how we process our own and others' death individually and as a society. This fear is based on not knowing what happens after death, fear of the event itself, fear of ceasing to be, and even the fear of not being able to die. And it changes over our lifetime. It generally increases over the years to peak at middle age and decreases until sometimes the very old are not afraid at all. However, cultures vary widely in the magnitude to which death anxiety is expressed. Some appear to manage the idea of dying so comparatively well that they are referred to as death-affirming societies. A good example of this is Mexico and their Day of the Dead celebrations. Another is a traditional First Nations practice around Kamloops, where for many years after someone has died, each year they disinter that person and dress them in new clothing. In other cultures, the aversion to dying is so strong that they are classified as death-denying or death-defying, and we, of course, are one of those. We are afraid to even say the word, preferring euphemisms such as passed on, no longer with us, departed. We maintain the deep currents of fear and guilt that people experience, and then we add avoidance. In fact, I have come across a psychological process to help resolve these anxieties called terror management theory. Over 30 years ago, I witnessed this avoidance in the community around me. A couple in our social circle had a dying newborn baby. When I saw the husband's distraught face, I offered to help in any way they needed, thinking I could be with them, but also that I could organize and galvanize our friends for support. The friends simply scattered, and I was left over my head. One woman literally hid in her basement. I finally had to just order these people around to participate, bring food, go to the funeral. How have we come to this? There are, of course, theories about the medicalization of death, the distancing of us from the process by the funeral industry, and ageism and family dispersal is probably there as well. But more important, how do we come back to a more balanced look at death? Mourning represents the culturally accepted expression of the personal feelings that follow the death of a loved one. Society polices grief. It controls and instructs how to think and feel and behave. It controls, and all societies have rules. In some cultures, for example, those who grieve should not cry. And in other cultures, there is ceremonial weeping or ritual wailing. To those who do not conform to the social expectations, they are labeled a parent. Yet it is now an axiom of grief counseling that there is no right way to grieve. This seems like a good thing, but it's also a problem. Mired in fear and fraudulent ceremony, how should we respond? Would authentic ritual and open conversation help? One of the unforeseen downsides of repressed grief are the other negative emotions that we generate, such as anger, resentment, depression, anxiety, and a deep sense of emptiness. These associated emotions can create a powerful negative cocktail, which can be even more harmful than the original loss and our natural emotion to grief. Talking can prevent a toxic tsunami of emotions from building up, that would other drag us deeper into a malaise of mental and emotional confusion. After a Muslim funeral, it is not uncommon for mourners to ask the bereaved family members about the details of the death shortly after the burial. More than curiosity, this dialogue can prove therapeutic. One quarter of the people in the UK feel uncomfortable talking about death to their families and friends. This lack of dialogue can add to the sufferer's sense of isolation and can be taken as a sign that they should no longer be grieving. Three quarters of the bereaved people in the UK claim that they did not receive the support that they needed. This can have damaging effects long after the funeral takes place. Death has been a major theme of mine as an artist. In the early 1990s, I began to make urns for human ash, two of which I've brought today. And an interesting thing began to happen. When I told people what I was doing, they would assume I was a sympathetic ear and tell me in detail about their grief. When I approached funeral homes with my product, the people were eager to tell me about their experiences, as if finding someone not part of their community would be interested. Those at Mountain View in Vancouver said that until the 1960s, cars would line up past the entrance on every major occasion to visit the deceased. Now few ever come. Also, when the ownership of the cemetery changed hands, they found thousands of urns in the basement that no one had bothered to come and collect. Paying attention to death through authentic processes over time, the bereaved can possibly earn more than equilibrium. Rewards may come through the realm of thought or meaning, which has been excluded from many definitions of both grief and mourning. When a significant person dies, the issue of meaning is central to the survivors. What does this death mean? What did this life mean? What did this person to me and to the community? Western individuals who successfully come to terms with a traumatic death may change how they think about themselves, how they relate to others, and how they view their own life in general. Within our culture, there are changes taking place. Much have begun by the death awareness movement from the 1960s. They spearheaded hospices and death education for children, which is as controversial as sex education. And the medical advances in keeping people alive, coupled with the medical assistance in dying, has forced us to consider whether life is worth living after a certain stage. How do lay chaplains help? When we are called, we request that as many family members as possible come and talk at length, helping to create what we're going to do. We allow the bereaved to speak for as long and as personally as they wish. And although most people will pursue a fairly traditional route, we encourage the bereaved to create a ceremony that meets their needs.
As I embarked on the journey of becoming a lay chaplain 11 years ago, I was excited at the prospect of performing wedding ceremonies. I mean, I was terrified, but in a good way. And the idea of child dedications made me feel all warm and cuddly. I mean, who doesn't love babies? But the part of the lay chaplain role that involves doing memorial services was really terrifying. How would I speak to the family? Would I get all wrapped up in their grief and be unable to do my job? Would their grief trigger sadnesses of my own? And if their mother could die, so could mine. Maybe it's catchy. I know I'm not alone in this trepidation. A lay chaplain colleague told me that she knew she'd always wanted to be a lay chaplain one day, but waited until she had experienced a death in her close family until she thought she was ready. Please be assured this is not a requirement. As a trainee, I took it upon myself to attend every memorial service I could, here at our church with our then minister, Reverend Jane Bramadat, our lay chaplains at the time, several of whom are here today, Fran, Pam, and Jan, with a lay chaplain from Capital, Peter, and out in the community with amid other faith traditions. Then there was the wonderful weekend training session sponsored by the CUC that every lay chaplain attends, which gave me the tools to use. Later, I spent quite a bit of time at home putting together resources I could quickly grab and go when I was called upon to do my first memorial service. Gradually, I became more at ease. I won't say confident, but just more at ease. And then came the day that I got that first phone call. It was from Reverend Jane. She asked, "Have you done a memorial service yet?" "Nope," my heart beating quicker. "Well," she said, "you soon will. Here's the name and phone number." Gulp. A family had called the church to ask for an officiant for their mother's service. Most of our clients come this way or through the website. Others come by personal referrals, but usually the people are strangers to us and in great need. So I made the call, asked some questions, arranged to meet the family, put together some materials based on what they told me about their mom, and set off to meet them. 3 days later, I had officiated my first memorial service. It was a revelation. I had not felt as useful in my role before. I found I was able to be that calm center in the midst of the family's sadness, and was able to smooth the way forward for them in some small way as they set about the process of reconfiguring their family's constellation. This feeling of deep usefulness prevailed through all the memorials I did in my term as a lay chaplain. Oh, the weddings were joyous, the child dedications heartwarming, the other services were challenging and creative, but memorials are the real heart of the work, and I'm honored to have been given the opportunity to walk with my clients for some small portion of their journey through grief, honored to serve in this profound way. I'm not alone in this feeling. If you talk to any lay chaplain, current or former, they will all tell you that their best work is memorials. To get to know another family so deeply and so meaningfully is a true gift of the lay chaplain's role. Now I serve as a trainer with my colleague, the Reverend Meg Roberts, to present that CUC weekend training for new lay chaplains. It's invariable that the students we meet feel the same way as I did as a trainee, and both of us reassure them. "Just wait," we say. "You will never feel better about the job you do as a lay chaplain than when you help a family honor, celebrate, and bid farewell to a loved one."
Good morning. So back in the late 70s, early 80s, I was very involved in musical theater, and a terrible disease started occurring in our group, which we now call AIDS. One of the things I discovered way back then is I had a weird, what I called weird, gift, and that was to be present and to sit with someone as they took their last breath. Now, unfortunately, back then, it wasn't as acceptable to be able to own your own sexual identity as it is today, thank heavens. So many people were shunned by their families, And if their partner had died first, they found that they were really alone. And so I was able, without any real training, to meet that need. But it encouraged me to go on and study and to get the qualifications I needed to be able to do this as a vocation. And I call it a vocation and not a career because I think it chose me. I didn't choose it. So how many of us really think about what it means to die? For some of us, we think, oh, if we even think about it, if we even write a will, it's going to happen. There's a superstition around death. We all know we're going to die, but most of us don't like to think about it until perhaps we get a diagnosis or someone close to us gets a diagnosis that will be life-altering. And there's no going back from that. We can't fix it. The doctors can't cure it. And so we come face to face with either our own death or the death of someone that we truly love. I say we need to prepare now when we're relatively healthy and relatively young to make sure that when our time does come, it isn't a surprise. And I think we may be comfortable going and getting our wills done and our personal directives, but what about spiritually? How in the world do we ever prepare to spiritually die? Well, the first thing I say is, let's not put it off. I don't care if you're really young or old like me, but I think that we need to start doing it now. We need to get comfortable. We need to talk about it. We need to forget about this death phobia that most of us have. So don't wait until that diagnosis happens. But I would invite you to have a curiosity about death. And when you hopefully do your meditations or write in your journals, I would like you to start today by including death as one of your topics of meditation. First thing, I think, what is a good death to you? And it will be something different for each one of you. It won't necessarily be what I think a good death is, but what does it mean to you? And to actually write that out and to claim that is my ideal death. Now, for sure, death is random. It can come at any time, and we don't really have any control of that. But what we do have control of is our own heart and our own mind, and to define how we would like our perfect death to be is an important act. You want to make sure your wishes are respected, and not only do you write it in your journal, but talk to your friends and your family about what your ideal death is, so that there's no running around at the last minute wondering, I wonder what they wanted. Do you know how many times I hear that in the hospital? Well, I think they wanted this, but they were never really clear. We never really talked about it. Why don't we talk about it? Because it makes our family uncomfortable, and we don't want to make our family uncomfortable or our friends. I know my children, I have a file. I call it If I Die File. And whenever I travel, I put it on my kitchen table. And my twin daughters will go, oh, Mom, don't tell us that. But you know what? Every password, these are practical things that they will need to know is in there. Right down to, I wrote my own obituary and my own eulogy because I'm a control freak. So spending that time to meditate on death, to allow yourself to really think about it. Like, what is it going to be like? What do I believe happens after death? And how can I prepare for that? So I say, start simple. Keep what I lovingly call the death journal. Now, the first question that you might want to ask yourself to write in your journal is, if I found out today that I only had a very short time to live, how would I live that time as long as I was physically able to do so? It's a shocking thing to think, and it happens to many of us. You go, you get, you know, you maybe had an ache or a pain, you go, and all of a sudden you're told, well, get your things in order because maybe you have a few months. And it's like, and no matter how old you are, whether you're very young, it can happen to a child, it can happen to an infant, and it can happen to every one of us. So what would you do? And if you would do it, and it's important, why aren't you doing it now? Because you have to always look at death as that balance between life and the end. Then I would ask myself, what scares me most about death? Is it the process? Is it the unknown of what will be after? I see death as this, the ultimate journey. I'm excited to find out what's on the other side, so to speak. Maybe there's nothing, and maybe that's part of your belief system, but I think there's an adventure. And talk to people, you know, what is the one tangible thing that's really important to you that the people around you need to know? Share with them your fears. Share with them your beliefs. Share with them how important they have been in your life. Don't wait to say, I love that you were in my life. You gave me so much. And let them know and thank them for that, whether they be your child or your friend. I say, make a list of the people that have pissed you off royally. We all have a few of those. And examine that. Sometimes we've broken off with family or friends over things that when we look back now, we say, that was so petty, so childish. And yet we hold on to those like they are gold. Is it time to forgive? Is it time to make peace? I think of the people that you love like crazy, you know, like that are so important to you. It's like the black and the white of those two things. They both need to be dealt with. They both need to know. And sometimes, even if you want to hold out an olive branch to people, they're not interested. They don't want to know. They're going to stay in their bitterness, and that's okay. But I think that it's important for us not to have any regrets. Regrets is an incredible waste of time anyway. It's like worry. You can keep yourself really busy worrying about what was or what might be, that you miss everything that's today. Imagine that you are dead and think about the chaos that happens around you. Can you mitigate that chaos by your honesty, by your openness, by your sharing? I believe that these are all spiritual practices. They're tangible, but they're also existential. They're spiritual practices that can allow us to continue to care for those that we love, even after we're gone. I think that, or I feel, that we all should just relax about death, because it's going to happen in its own good time. We may be able to control that, medical assistance in dying here in Canada, which is, for me, one of the greatest gifts the government has ever given us as Canadians, that we have that choice now. I participate and support people and families afterwards. Actually, I have a support group that for just the families and friends of people that have chosen MAID here in Victoria. That is such an autonomous gift that we now have to make that choice for those of us that are ill and are suffering. But otherwise, death really does itself. The only thing that we really can control about it is how we think about it, how we plan for it. Not just doing the will and paying for the funeral and all those tangible things, but to spiritually make friends with death, which sounds so odd. There's actually some really good books out with, by that title, a couple of Buddhist books and some funny books. But, you know, making friends with death. I call it learning to dance with death more than making friends. But I think we need to talk a little bit about regret, because regret is just some kind of a past reference point that we tend to hold on to. What can we do to adjust who we are today to mitigate regret, to let it go? I spend a lot of time with people at the bedside at end of life. A lot of private conversations when there's no family there. It's just me and the person in the middle of their dying process that still are cognitively aware and can talk. I think what I hear the most is, I wish I had lived the life I wanted, not the life other people wanted for me. What would you do, starting right in this moment, would be honesty for who you are as a person, not what your mother wanted you to be, or your spouse, or your brothers and sisters, or what's expected of you, but what do you want for your life? Because you now have a chance to create that. Second, probably right around up, it's almost neck and neck, but I wish I hadn't spent so much time at work, right? How many family, fun life experiences have you put aside thinking that, well, I'll do that later, I'll do it when I retire, or, you know, I'll take a vacation in a couple months, but right now I've got to do this work. You know what? When you're done at work, you're gone, maybe a week or two, you're replaced. They don't care. You know who cares? The people, the children that you pushed off. They're the ones that wish they had more time. And you're going to wish you had more time. And then I wish I had the courage to express how I really feel. How do you feel? Do you honestly tell the people around you how you feel? Or are you always trying to make things nice, or you're embarrassed to share how much you love someone? My friends laugh at me because as soon as I say, so I need a little clarity, they go, oh. Because they know I'm going to ask a really hard question. But how honest are we? How honest are we with ourselves? Most of us lie to ourselves. I wish I'd stayed in touch with friends. How many times do you, maybe you're going through a box and you find old Christmas cards and you think, oh, you know, I lost touch with Bob or Jim or Susie or Sally. I really liked them. We had so much fun together. Do you try to contact them? It's one good thing about Facebook. It's the only good thing I can say about it. But, you know, like you might be able to find them again. And they will be as happy to hear from you as you are to reconnect with them. And lastly, I believe happiness is a choice. And too often we forget to make that choice. That choice to choose. We cannot control what happens to us and in our lives, but we can control how we respond to it. I choose happy. I choose laughing. There is always humor to be found, even in the most dire situations. And so when we learn to see death as a dance partner or as a friend that will come to collect us one day, that honesty with ourselves of knowing that we have prepared the best we could is the most important gift that we will give not only to those we love, but to ourselves. So all of us sitting here today have that opportunity, I think, to make friends with death because we're still breathing. And also with the death of the people that we love. So you can choose to say, oh, that was a weird service today, and ignore everything that we've shared. Or you can choose to go buy yourself a beautiful new journal and every day spend 5 or 10 minutes writing in that journal. Those of us that are old birds, we need to spend a little bit more time, but, and address death. Address it and make friends with it so that when it's your turn, you can embrace what most of us find or think would be not very embraceable. Let it be so.